speaking on behalf of Serene Dien, who is currently in Dakar and was unable to come back for this. Last year, at the end of 2006, UNICEF contacted us and asked if we could do some intense qualitative participatory action research in Burkina Faso and Nigeria. They were particularly concerned about the issues of livelihoods and food security in West Africa, and they wanted us to look at both Nigeria and one other country, a Francophone and an Anglophone country. The reason they were concerned, you can see that in 2006 there were outbreaks that began in sort of Francophone and Anglophone West Africa, and they've continued sporadically in some countries, but it looks like Nigeria and Ghana may be becoming endemic. So this is a real concern. And there's been one confirmed human death in Nigeria in January this year. The sentiment is that there have probably been other deaths that have gone unreported and unnoticed. Right, we partnered with UNICEF to do the research in peri-urban and rural sites in Burkina Faso, where there were two sites, in Lagos State, where there were two sites, and in Kano State, Nigeria, so one from the south and one from sort of the north of Nigeria. And the objectives were to understand how communities thought about AI. There was at least one community in each of the countries that had suffered an outbreak of AI, that had, you know, immediate experience of it. We also were very interested, as I mentioned, on livelihood and food security, and we were interested in what might be barriers and facilitators to the practices that Nora has mentioned, or similar practices. We used the participatory action research process, which has some really important principles of inclusion, participation, and self-determination, which is basically that communities really are part of the research. They're not researched upon, they themselves research. And this starts by identifying people from within the community to facilitate the research process and talking them through the different methods, and then they are in fact integral members of the team. Other important aspects of PAR are that it triangulates. You use multiple tools, different kinds of ways of gathering information. You get the information from different groups in the community, and here we made a particular effort, in addition to getting information from men and women, to get it from young people, from youth. And you do replicates. You always ask the same thing twice so that you have a way of comparing information. It's also, there's an ordered implementation. Every evening, the team reflects on what they've learned that day and decides what the next steps are and how to focus the next day's work. And you move from sort of general observations to the specific. Here's the schedule that we used in I think it was Burkina Faso. They're all a little bit different because the teams moved some of the methods around. So you can see it took 7 days in the community. There were additional days of analysis after because we did the analysis for each community and then for the two sites in a country, and then for in Nigeria we had the north and south that were analyzed together. So it's a way of building up, sort of collecting information. And the first day is built in this is after the facilitators have been identified, in team building, orienting them, talking through how things will work. And then one of the first exercises is community mapping. You go through the community and identify where birds are kept, where different things happen. Then in the evening there's feedback, data review and planning. The next day there's observation, and it goes on like that, so that each day sort of builds on the information gathered in the day before. Then finally on the seventh day, it's restitution with the community. You present your findings to the community and you ask them for their input. And this is usually a very large community gathering. And at that time, people can ask questions, they can say, no, you're wrong, and sort of redirect things. And it's a very, very it's a very, very active participation that you get by this point. So now I'm going to talk about the findings of this. The main finding is that there's complete sharing of human and chicken social and physical space. It is really impossible in that context to think about how to separate them. It does not seem to be possible. There were differences between Burkina Faso and Nigeria. Burkina Faso was, on the whole, more rural. People there were really backyard farmers. They had very small flocks of chickens and guinea fowl, usually. Chickens are kept closer to home. The guinea fowl are kept near the fields. They use the money from occasional sales for school fees, for buying things like seed, and for paying for health care. So you get birds being sold at certain times of the year. Before school starts, people need school fees. So there's a lot of movement of poultry. At the beginning of the agricultural season, there's a lot of movement of poultry. These are actually danger times, because with movement of poultry, you get the possibility of transmission of infection. In Nigeria, there were backyard farmers as well with the same sort of pattern. But there was also both a small and a larger commercial sector. Now, small means people who, there was one woman who had literally 500 birds in her back bedroom that she was raising. And then you have people who have several thousand birds. And they may not be in the business permanently. It may be something sort of transient. They don't have good biosecurity practices, mostly because they're entrepreneurs. They're trying to do something at a particular time. So they're particularly interesting. We found that in addition to keeping birds to sell, that one of the most important, I'd say probably the emotionally the most important use of chickens was ritual. In both countries, people really felt that they had to have chickens. In Nigeria, it was the gods really won't accept anything but chicken blood. In the community in Burkina Faso that had had the outbreak of AI and where all the chickens had died, people actually went to a village that had not had an outbreak, and they were forbidden from restocking their chickens for several months because the government didn't want them reinfecting and keeping the infection going. They actually went to communities that still had chickens. They bought feathers, and they used the feathers in their ceremonies sort of as placeholders. They still will have to sacrifice the chickens, but they felt that this was such an integral part of the ceremony that they couldn't forego it. In Nigeria, we're not sure how widespread this belief is, but it did come up. The chickens are kind of a protective wall, that if something has to die, that it's better that it be your chickens than your children. And if this belief is widespread, it has big implications for culling, because people then are removing the protective wall against misfortune. So very, very important thinking around chickens that we uncovered. They're also used as gifts to maintain and strengthen social ties. And people could think about substitutes. They said, we can give gifts of yams or gifts of other things. And chickens are not necessarily crucial here. And then really almost last on the list was chickens as food. People don't habitually eat it. It's usually reserved for feasts. Even eggs are not eaten that commonly. We found that ownership of chickens was actually pretty complex. And this has got real gender implications. In Burkina Faso, particularly in the more rural areas, a woman might even purchase a chicken with money that she had gained through selling small amounts of vegetables that she'd raised, but it was still considered to be her husband's chicken. And when the birds were culled, it was the husband who got the compensation that was paid. And so we found this interesting. In Nigeria, particularly in the urban areas, and there were women who had small commercial establishments. So there was still an aspect of deference to the head of the household, and it wasn't clear if the person who actually had acquired and cared for the chicken was necessarily the person who got remunerated for it when culling happened. The Nigeria and Burkina Faso, people said that it was brought by migrating birds. And in Burkina, they had actually noticed wild birds dying, which was quite interesting. And in both sites, they also said that foreign traders had brought birds into the community. This is what they mean by foreign. In Burkina Faso, they also noted that because it had happened during Harmattan, they associated it with wind and dust. But they also had a very naturalistic explanation that birds would eat contaminated food or drink water, or vultures would eat dead birds that had died of it and thereby get it. In Nigeria, there was really a striking prevalence of rumor and people saying that it had been deliberately introduced from other countries, or that the rich had introduced it because they wanted to wipe out the middle and lower end of the trading spectrum. And this occurred, we heard this in both Kano and in Lagos. The factors that we noted that could affect transmission were this seasonal movement of poultry. I mentioned the school fees, the agricultural season. The fact that people trade poultry quite extensively and that they don't necessarily acquire it from the same source each time, or sell it to the same source each time. There's no sort of trusted chain of commerce, if you will. Poultry roam freely. They have contacts with wild birds, which is probably a source of infection in West Africa. That people were, as Nora noted for Southeast Asia, they don't feel particularly susceptible to this because they feel that there's a lot of mortality that's normal. Newcastle disease is endemic in this area. There, every so many years, you have rather large numbers of birds dying in a short period, and this is just what happens. So AI seemed to be an extreme example of this, but really not extraordinary. There was not a lot of reporting of sick birds. This is particularly true, well, it was more true in Nigeria than in Burkina Faso. You know, why would you report a sick bird? I mean, birds get sick and die all the time, is sort of people's response. And only the very largest commercial entities used veterinarians. Okay, we're also interested in human exposure. People would wash themselves after cleaning out chicken houses, but they'd use water. And the main motivator for washing, it turned out, was the smell. And the same thing was true after slaughtering birds. It wasn't sort of that they thought it was dirty. It wasn't that they could see dirt on their hands, but it was that their hands smelled. No changing of clothes, not really enough clothes, changes of clothes to do that after cleaning. There was no particular care about chicken droppings, nor, you know, any thought that they might be infectious. People were hard-pressed. In many communities, they ate birds that were ill. They would, if a bird started to fall ill, they would slaughter it and eat it before it could infect the rest of the flock, or they would eat birds that had fallen dead. Now, there are some communities that have a cultural aversion to this practice, but even in those communities, the very poorest people did eat the dead birds. The other thing is that people didn't see any negative consequences for eating birds that had fallen dead. It's something that's very common. Newcastle has no ill effects on humans. So this was something that would be particularly difficult to persuade people about. And in Nigeria, there were stories of people who had gone to places where there were infections, had bought the birds as the prices fell, transported them elsewhere, and sold them. So this is one way that the infection was being spread in Nigeria. In Burkina Faso, we found that because people fear thieves, they build chicken houses with very small doors. This is a reason that kids get exposed, because only very small kids can get inside those doors, either to collect eggs or to clean the houses. And so if you want to reduce kids' exposure to chickens and to chicken feces in this society, you really have to figure out a way not only to build chicken houses that are, you know, but to deter the thieves. I mean, this is a larger cultural problem. These are not simple problems to solve. Okay, and then we looked at the impact and on livelihoods. The price of chicken typically in a place with the first outbreak falls by about 70% and stays down for a while, about 6 months. This has a knock-on effect. People whose livelihood is based on chicken, the small commercial traders, the people who produce feed, and the people who sell, who sort of transport chicken to sell, really all lose work. And then the ones who depend on it for school fees, you have people not going to school because of the falling prices. There's reduced consumption of chicken, and in Burkina Faso, it wasn't the fact chicken's not consumed, but you sell your bird in order to buy staples. And so they figured about 20% of the income went to that. And then in Nigeria, because the middle class, in more urban settings, the middle class would stop eating chicken, would switch to fish and meat, and the prices of those would rise. And so people's other and more common sources of protein, in fact, became too expensive to buy. Second impact, I've talked about the religious aspects of life, a real problem. And then finally on health, same effect as for the school fees. Things that were used to pay for school fees were no longer available. And finally, the response to culling. In Burkina Faso, people accepted culling. There was a much more communitarian spirit, and in fact, one community said, look, if our birds are sick, we'll cull them ourselves so that our neighbors' birds don't get sick. Compensation varied. In Nigeria, there was real disagreement about compensation, and people were very upset. The authorities thought that it was just something that would help people out whose chickens were culled. The communities, and this is particularly the small commercial traders, thought that they should get the value of the chicken before the outbreak, and that they should be paid not just for the chickens that were culled, but for the ones that had died. So kind of a government insurance, if you will. Clearly unaffordable. And I just wanted to acknowledge the teams that we had in Burkina Faso and in Nigeria. This is the big Burkina Faso team, and this is the Nigeria team. Thank you. Selling them, that's a very good question. There's a chain of commerce that reaches to the urban areas where you've got more of a middle class and rich. We were doing studies in peri-urban, sort of villages outside the urban area and in rural areas. So, and there's actually a very interesting segmented chain of traders that does this. I mean, from poultry collectors on bicycles to ones on motorbikes to ones in jeeps, and poultry get collected at different junctures. Thank you.